I've been waiting. When that robot voice comes in, you know it's time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you've got your raincoat on, you got your umbrella extended, and you're strolling through getting your last bit of April showers before those May flowers. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free, thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those fine folks make this show possible with their generosity, their commitment, their support. It means that we get to make more episodes. And in exchange, they get some cool stuff, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a bunch of bonus content. You got spoiler casts. You got your Feeling This, which is an entire show with Alex Solman and Christian Spicer. Two seasons of that for patrons. You got the DLC Book Club audio. And you got the Wednesday paid DLC program with Lana Bashinsky joining us for some wild and wacky conversations about all sorts of topics. We don't know what's going to come up. It's a good time. It's loved by all. And it's exclusive. Exclusive, as I said. Only for patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games. In their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, the spell with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who's bringing tie-dye back. Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Oh, yeah. For our video viewers, this is homemade. Family nice. And I, we did our own dyes. I love these intros you've been doing for a while now. The intros are always great, but maybe for the last month or 2 months, you might not know this, dear listeners, but at some point in there, you always figure out what the weather is like at Jeff's house. Maybe you're shopping. Maybe you just finished doing your kids' laundry. Maybe you just made pasta, primadora for your family. And maybe it's a 20% chance of ice on the roads today. So pack an umbrella and a jacket. It's going to be a cold one.
It's a whole new thing for me, Christian. Weather.
Weather. Exactly.
I never had it before I moved here to Denver, and it's a delight, weather, to experience it. It's very, very observant of you. Hey, we got a great show for you. We got tons of stuff to talk about. It's going to be a really interesting news segment, and we got great games to get to. Oh, it's going to be a great show, and one of the biggest reasons for that is we have a great guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, once again, DLC stands for developers who are littler by comparison. Because from the Indie Informer, we have our friend Jill Grote back with us. Hi, Jill. How are you?
Good. That was fantastic. I was like, what are you going to make DLC into for like indie stuff? But that was great. Absolutely fantastic.
It's a good week to have you on because we got some fun indies to talk about. I'm excited to hear about some of the stuff you've been playing. And I, you know, honestly, it's becoming clearer and clearer to me as I get older that my tastes are just going more in the indie direction than ever before.
Yeah.
I love a great, big, splashy AAA game. I'm not going to lie. But it tends to me to be the case that week after week, I'm more delighted playing a new indie game than I ever have been. And so it's awesome to talk to you. And I love your website as well as a great resource for finding those.
Thank you so much. I think another good reason for this being a good week to have me on, I've noticed the past, I think, 2 weeks you've had extended Game Informer fam guests.
Yes.
So you're just continuing on with the trend.
Yeah, that's great. That's right. You fit right in. It's our theme month of April, you know.
Game Informer.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's get into it and start the show the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments, questions, anything you'd like us to know. Please reach out. We love hearing from you. dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But there's another way to have your voice heard as well. You can show up to our Discord, which is 5x5 DLC on Discord. Great folks hanging out there talking about all sorts of stuff. Take part. It's a blast. But Jill, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Story of the week? Just throwing my eyes over this doc here. I am so excited to hear that El Paso Elsewhere is getting a movie adaptation. I mean, for a lot of reasons. Obviously, I'm the indie informer, and indies are a great love of mine. But the developer who works at Strange Scaffold, Xavier, and I can never say his name right. I'm so sorry, Xavier. Xavier Nelson Jr. is an absolutely fantastic human being. If you ever get the chance, you should speak with him. But this was one of the games from last year that should have won so many more awards than it did, but it was nominated, BAFTA nominated, and in all other kinds of places. And it was, if you did not see it, El Paso Elsewhere is a sort of Max Payne inspired. You are going after your ex, who just happens to also be Lord of the Underworld and Dracula vampire-esque woman who is gonna end the world. And I knew I was all in on this game when you have one of the opening, I think it might be the opening cinematic, where it is a character, and the character is like lo-fi, you know. Yeah. You're looking at like PS1, I don't know if there are eyes there, like almost pixelated, but they're looking at you in the camera and they're giving you like this monologue that's heavy, and it's deep into like addiction and like how they're giving up everything they had in life to be able to save the world. They're not going to make it out. This is a one-way trip. And they look you in the eyes through the camera and say, I need you to believe in me or else this isn't going to work. And then they count to three. And if you believe enough, that they will be where they need to be. And then they are. And I'm like, I did that.
Yeah, really, really cool news, as you said, to hear that this we're getting this next wave of video games going to be turned into other media, TV shows, movies. Obviously, Fallout is this huge hit right now. We had The Last of Us. We're getting all of these, you know, Halo TV show is in its, you know, third season, I think now. These things that are kind of getting traction. And I think those big AAA, you know, big mainstream household name IP, I think are opening the door for these lesser known games to get. Yes. That. And we've talked in previous weeks about how there's all these kind of things percolating. There's all these projects coming up. And here's another one that was just announced this week. I agree with you. I think the coolest part of El Paso Elsewhere is its storytelling and its style. You know, it is dripping with style. And I think that's cool. I love the fact this to me makes sense. It feels like this is going to be such a killer movie. 100%. And it sounds like Lakeith Stanfield,
yes,
is in line to play the lead, which I think is great casting. Love him. I think he's awesome. So who knows? No director mentioned yet. We don't have any kind of release date. So this could be a couple of years off or whatever. But really cool to hear El Paso Elsewhere is going to be a movie.
Yeah. Whenever it comes out, I'll be there. Day one, day two, day three, however long I can see it, I'm going to be checking it out.
The question I have about this to you specifically, okay, as the indie informer, do you think there needs to be or should be an overt reference, mention, acknowledgement of the fact that this is a video game in the marketing of this film? Do you think that this is the kind of thing that should push people to the video game, or can it just live on its own as an adaptation and people can find that or not find that as they may?
I think it should be its own thing. But I think you never really have a situation where you have a movie where people don't walk out and be like, oh, by the way, did you know that was a video game? And that's sort of how you get that word of mouth. I think if they do it in the media itself, it kind of can take away, obviously, like hints and nods to people who have played the game and that sort of thing, or Easter eggs are always fun.
Yeah.
But to like legitimately call that out in the opening trailer of like based on the, I mean, I guess they could do a based on the game by blah, blah, blah. But I don't think it needs to. I think the story, like we were saying, is so good. And the cinematography of the game is so fantastic and so stylish that it will translate very well to a video format anyway. So I don't think people, unlike a lot of movies, like let's go with the Mario movie, you know, like
right.
People are using that Mario angle to push people to the movie because a big franchise and whatever, but because El Paso Elsewhere is an indie, a lot of people aren't going to be aware of it, even if they are in the gaming space. So that's right. Not necessarily going to be like, oh, it's a video game, I should go check it out. And that might even actually be a detriment because of the bad reputation that adaptations tend to have. Mm-hmm. So if you do start it as just a movie and people check it out and they love it, and then they find out later, oh, it's also a game, I should check that out. I think that is a more winning formula than trying to do it the other way around.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm inclined to agree. Christian, I know you were a big fan of El Paso Elsewhere, the game. What do you make of a film adaptation potentially starring Lakeith Stanfield?
What's Robert Rodriguez doing? You know, like where can we grindhouse this up a little bit? Can we? I think it makes a lot of sense as a film. The story's interesting. The Max Payne movie is not good, but that style of cinematography and even going, I think cinema is also ready to, and we're seeing some of this, but I think we're ready to see more of it, do something similar to what the game did and being a throwback. The game is very graphically PlayStation 1 era style, Max Payne 1, basic polygonal work. And I think we're accepting that in film as well, like going back to 90, jeans are wider again, 90s is very much in again, the 90s era. And I think having a slow-mo bullet hell movie, I think we're ready for that. You know, at the time there was every John Woo movie, Matrix. We had so many of these movies. Wasn't DMX in one too? Like him and somebody that had like a, I forget, but like every movie had the, like they were, everybody's trying to do it. Right. And it felt, it got played out and it became annoying. And how many underworld movies did we have? And it kind of just became, you know, the snake ate its own tail. But I think we're ready for it again to be done in a knowing way, but with modern technology that can make all of that look better in a really cool way. And as Jill talked about, the plot of this game, and I really enjoyed the game, I think it tells its story well, but the plot of the game, I mean, to me, it feels like From Dusk Till Dawn meets the Tortured Poets Department. And it's like, I want that. I want all of that. So I think it makes a lot of sense. And I don't think it needs to market it as a game. Movie. I think you see that when they're trying to bring a large audience to a new thing. And unfortunately, I also agree with Jill. I think part of what you said implied this. I don't think El Paso Elsewhere got the sales or recognition it deserved. So I think Jill and I are ready to go day one, but I don't think there are fallout legion of fans, you know, pounding on the door to see this day one. Whereas when you have a huge following like that, you want to, hey, every Fallout fan, we're making a show, you know, it's going to be a hit. So I think this thing's going to stand on its own. And I think people are going to find the game because of it. The game does awesome stuff with sound also.
Yes.
Really cool score that I think can be incorporated really well in cinema. It does really cool stuff with its typeface, much in the same way that Control did, where it's kind of jarring and uncomfortable at times. I think that's going to work really well in cinema. And the whole location of it being this hotel in hell, you know, that slowly descends into madness. Yeah, it's all there. I'm stoked.
Speaking of slowly descending into madness, you have reminded me of something that happened very recently when talking with someone slightly younger than me, but not a lot younger than me, where they turn to me and ask, like, do you remember that really old movie, The Matrix?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, oh no, that's where I am right now.
That's when you reply with a straight face. No.
No, that must have come out
before I was born. Thank you.
We just did on our paid DLC program. We do the show with our friend Lana Bashinsky, who's a developer at Riot, and quite a bit younger than either of us.
Than you, especially, yeah.
Mostly way younger than me, and significantly younger than Christian. But we just recently did a question about the first R-rated movie we saw when we were too young to see R-rated, you know, like the movie you saw that you weren't supposed to see. And for her, it was The Matrix. And I was like, oh, I'm old.
Yep, that'll do it.
Yeah. Anyway, El Paso Elsewhere. Also, just the strength of the title alone. That's a great title. El Paso Elsewhere. Great title for a movie, for video game, for anything. Great title. So I you know, that goes a long way too. That should be showing up in movie theaters, you know, in the next couple of years. Pretty exciting. And I love that indie games are getting a little of that rub from Hollywood. Very cool. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk about, but I'm going to pick one, Jeff. I'm going to pick one. My story of the week this week, which I texted to you, which I'm sure you probably already saw. But when I saw it, I was like, ooh, ping this to Jeff for sure.
Yeah.
The on again, off again relationship with BlizzCon is off again. It's off. No, yeah. Microsoft acquired them, and there was like, what is it going to do? And they're like, BlizzCon's back. We're back. But everybody was like, yeah, BlizzCon. And they announced, I think they even announced ticket pricing, maybe. I thought, maybe not. And then this week they're like, it's not happening. No, BlizzCon. We love you, but we're not doing it. And I think that's fascinating in this Microsoft era. The reason why I think it's a bigger story than just like, hey, not happening again is I am very curious to see what Blizzard's identity is now. Like, in hindsight, it's easy to look back at Blizzard throughout the years. Oh, this is the Morhaime era. This is the pre-Activision era. This is WoW, what we now call WoW Classic era. This is, you know, all these eras. And I'm very curious what the Microsoft era ends up being. And this very, very well may be the first kind of marker of that going forward. So I'm curious.
That's interesting dots to connect. I did not connect those dots, but I guess that one must, seeing as how, you know, Microsoft is on some level calling the shots. It is interesting. You know, BlizzCon has been happening since what, 2005? Yeah. Obviously the COVID years, they did not happen. And there was some controversial stuff going on with Blizzard, and there was, but it did come back. And this is the first time they have not had a BlizzCon without some kind of global pandemic preventing it since 2005. Mm-hmm. And I think that alone is notable. Also notable, they don't explain why. There's no reason given other than we decided not to. We thought about it long and hard and we decided not to. Now, this is the 30th anniversary year for Warcraft, the original RTS Warcraft, celebrating their 30th anniversary. Blizzard has announced a bunch of kind of things they're doing to commemorate that milestone in 2024. You'd think their giant successful convention would rally around that year event. If they're doing things to celebrate 30 years of Warcraft anyway, you would think, why not have this giant party that we throw annually in Anaheim? And so to me, the biggest part of this story is the huge question mark as to why cancel it. What do you think, Jill?
I wonder if it's a lot tied up with larger macro things happening in the gaming space, sort of like, obviously, Microsoft earlier this year let a lot of people go. And so there is some financial things that are going on. And I'm wondering how much of this is like a lot of different companies that did conventions and things like E3, that's gone away, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And people who went to conventions or not, like Nintendo said they were pulling out of Gamescom. Like, I wonder how many of these companies are looking at the bottom line, that number, and saying, you know, maybe it's not worth it to do these in-person things. And then you think about Blizzard's sort of controversy still kind of roaming around and them thinking like maybe it's not financially viable, but also maybe they want, maybe Microsoft wants to get away from having protesters and that kind of thing show up to their stuff. And maybe that's why they're not saying anything about why they're not doing it, because you don't really want to say, we don't want to spend the money and we don't want people showing up and having bad press. So I don't know. Like, obviously they're saying they're going to have a BlizzCon, like it's not going away permanently.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think.
Well, they're saying that now. Who knows, yes. You know?
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking like E3 was very clear about like, yeah, we're coming back. Don't worry about it.
Put money on it. E3 is coming back.
Oh, my dad said the same thing when he went to go get those cigarettes. He said he'd be right.
Yeah. Just get milk, honey.
Yeah. Also, nobody blame me if it doesn't come back. I'm so sorry.
Right. You jinxed it. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you – you say we're canceling BlizzCon forever in the first press release. But yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, it'll be interesting. They certainly are not without announcements to make, right? Or things to show off. We have a big World of Warcraft expansion coming later this year, The War Within. And we have Diablo 4's first expansion, Vessel of Hatred, that's slated for this year as well. They say in the press release, we're going to have more details coming about those launches in the next few months. So, you know, there was material there that they could have built an event on. So it's not like they were without announcements to make, without products to shill. You know, there was a lot of stuff to be said at a BlizzCon. So you may be right, Jill, that this may be more of like, we don't want to take the PR headache of whatever this might stir up. We don't want to spend the cash. Although, you know, they sell tickets to BlizzCon. I don't know if it is ever a money loser. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know. But it is strange and it is notable that it's not happening in 2024. I think it's disappointing a lot of people. Blizzard is one of those companies that laid off a lot of people, and Microsoft, their parent company, laid off a lot of people. So maybe you're right that this has something to do with that reorganization, restructuring, that just sort of like, let's get our ducks in a row this year and figure out what 2025 is going to bring.
Yeah, and I'm curious what Microsoft's approach to conferences is or was or I guess becomes, because forever ago, PlayStation, what did they call it? The PlayStation Experience, whatever. But PlayStation had a conference, I think it was pretty much right next door to BlizzCon one year, like that same office park convention area in Anaheim. And way back then, Jeff, when we were doing this show, back when Lana was sneaking into the Matrix, you know, forever ago, mm-hmm. I talked about how much I loved that PlayStation conference. And I think for several of our prediction episodes, I predicted that this would be the year Microsoft is going to do one. It's low-hanging fruit. It's an easy way to rally your fan base. For our listeners who aren't in their Wayback Machine with me, that's also the time when TwitchCon was huge and everything, all these cons were huge. And it was easy to do. It seemed easy to do all of these cons. And all it did is turn mild fans into the most hardcore fans. Like everybody would go there, like, I guess I'll go to this conference. And then they leave with like the PlayStation, you know, triangles like tattooed across their forehead, all of the gear and just like hardcore fan. And Microsoft never did that. They did kind of do their own thing, but it was always at the same time as E3, literally right next door to E3 in the space that they owned. That was part of E3. Like
there was an Xbox convention a few years. It was a while back.
I don't think there was.
Like they do a Microsoft Fan Fest, but I don't know if there's a physical fan presence fest. For it. A huge physical presence for it.
FanFest, they would do a physical thing at their E3 showing that was part of that.
I think they've done a FanFest outside of E3 before.
They definitely did a FanFest because I went to a couple of them.
Okay.
This may have been many years ago.
At E3?
No. This was not even at the same time as E3.
I'm always the one who's like participating in the like long distance stuff. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They do. They still do those, like the long distance fan fest. I don't know. Maybe they did. I feel like they didn't do one again when PlayStation was doing one. But again, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Put in the subject line, Christian, you're an idiot, and like link me. I'm very easily wrong. But right, for a while,
I found a website called Xbox Fan Fest, a look back at the history of the event. The very first FanFest was in 2015. That it was at E3. So maybe I'm misremembering this. FanFest 2017. All right. Well, this is great audio. Let me just be scrolling down this website. I'm sure
a lot of them were part of E3. And I think they did have like fan meetups, but I think kind of as Jill was saying, they weren't big. You know, they weren't like conferences with announcements and Phil on stage. And I could be wrong, but I don't think they ever did anything. And they certainly never spun one up as a response to what Sony was doing back in the day with their conferences, where Sony had this one. I mean, they were spending money. They had, I think it was like Nate's Attic from Uncharted 4 or something like that, like recreated, and you could go through there and they had
I might be conflating, because they would Sony for years did one in December that was whatever they called it. I can't remember what it was called either, but it was the Sony
event. And they had like reveals there. They did like a whole, I think Dreams or one of those, like had a huge presentation on stage, like a real deep dive. We hung out with Khalif. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't think Microsoft has ever really had that presence outside of other, you know, Gamescom, E3 style stuff. And I'm curious in today's media age, what the value add is perceived of those things. Mm-hmm. I'm the weirdo who thinks there's probably more value in them now, like actually getting people together. It's like, oh, we're all connected. The internet makes it all so easy. We're all connected. But man, I love going to a live comedy show or a concert or a baseball game or a NWLS game and like NWSL, had the L and the S the wrong way, together. Like there, I feel like I crave that more now in our AI smartphone filled world, that I think if BlizzCon does come back, I think it could be a real special thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it was always one of my favorite things to go to. I'm a huge Blizzard fan, and I went for almost all of them. I remember there was a while where like the only one I missed was the birth of my son. But then, you know, then COVID happened and then, you know, things changed, but it'll be a sad thing. I think if BlizzCon goes away completely, it will be interesting to see what 2025 brings, but no BlizzCon for 2024. All right. Let's take a quick break for a sponsor and we'll come back with my story of the week. All right. My story of the week is a rumor. We're getting more info about what Switch 2, or whatever they're going to call it, Super Switch, Switchersons, the Switch Nintendo, that doesn't switch, I don't know.
Nintendo 65.
There you go.
That's how you know it's the new one. Yeah.
I like it. game rectangle.
No? You know, you can't put anything Nintendo might do is possible.
Like, it's true. It's true.
They make some decisions and you're just like, okay.
Call it the dolphin, finally. anyway, Switch 2, we've reported on the show as well, reported other people's reports, that supposedly pushed into 2025, not happening this year after all.
Some idiot predicted it would happen this year. Just a real, real loser.
Speaking of jinxing things, my goodness. so that supposedly not happening this year. We don't have any official word from Nintendo. In fact, you know, worst kept secret in gaming, because they have not even said they're working on a Switch 2, and everybody just has assumed. People have been predicting this thing was going to come out for the last 3 years in a row. Anyway, we're getting more reports as to what actually a Switch 2 or whatever it's going to be called is going to look like. And a new Spanish-based website called Vandal has reported some things about how it's going to be larger than the original Switch, not quite as large as the Steam Deck, for example. But the big news this week is that supposedly the Joy-Cons are going to be detachable, just as with the original Switch, but they will attach to the console using magnets. Magnets are going to attach it. They're going to be larger than the Joy-Cons now, which, as an adult human, hooray. I mean, I love that Nintendo creates its stuff for, you know, children mostly and small hands. And my children are grateful to have accessories that fit in their hands great. But I'm excited that the Joy-Cons will be a little bigger. I find them very uncomfortable to use, especially separated. But so they're going to be a little bit bigger, and they will that the Switch 2 is going to be backwards compatible. It'll also be compatible with current Switch Pro controllers, which is good news for me because I have like four of those things from my kids. Anyway, so but the big news is the magnets. The magnets, which, you know, I got all excited about the story and now it's saying it out loud. It's like, is this even news? But I do think that's cool. I do think the idea of a of Joy-Cons that snap like with magnets to the outside sounds neat. But I think moreover, what makes this a story of the week for me is how similar this thing sounds to the Switch. Like, they're not reinventing the wheel. A company that has famously reinvented the wheel over and over and over again. Jill, Switch is the home of indie games. It's really, they've embraced indie games. What do you make of magnets on the Joy-Cons?
I'm not surprised. The amount of people I've heard of or heard from who've like snapped one or like put it in the wrong way and can't get it back out. So I'm not surprised they're reinventing some of the things. I'm glad to hear that they are listening to feedback because Nintendo is such a weird company that a lot of the times it seems like they just do things. So hearing that the magnets for me is proof that they are hearing things from people and wanting to make the experience better. It is so funny that you mentioned they have not even confirmed that they are working on this thing, and we are up to here's all of the, you know, all the tiny little things that might be happening with all it. Right. I mean, the Indie Council, one of the podcasts that I'm on, we already did our Switch 2 like perfect indie lineup, you know, like, we did that last year because all these rumors have been swirling around and we know it's going to happen. Like, there's no way it's not going to happen. So I think that's why these rumors are so easy to pick up and to run with. And they're always on fire because you want it to happen. I am surprised that Tears of the Kingdom came out before the Switch 2 because you just want like, the Switch is kind of chugging along, you know? Like, I want such an upgrade in the next console. I don't know if we're going to get it because, you know, they do still want to keep it a certain degree of, I don't know, friendliness or something. they don't want it to be this, like, massive Steam Deck type thing.
Yeah.
And I get that. And I think the Steam Deck is also a really cool thing to bring up in this conversation because I think the Nintendo didn't have competition for this kind of handheld gaming sphere for a while until the Steam Deck came up. Mm-hmm. And now they might be a little worried about it, you know, because you said that Switch and Nintendo is sort of the home of the indie. And it was. That's true. But more and more, especially with the Steam Deck coming out, the space for an indie is, well, it's always been computer and Steam and because that's a very friendly space. But like more and more people are buying Steam Decks specifically to be their indie machine.
Yeah.
And so I think that Nintendo needs to be keeping an eye on this stuff. So inventing a new, like the magnets are a really cool thing because it just proves that they are trying to be competitive, and that's great.
I agree. Yes. It's interesting that the Switch logo was always that snap, like the two things clicking together, you know, sliding in and clicking. And I wonder if their new logo or insignia or whatever will acknowledge that in some new way, that it'll click together, you know, instead of sliding. Maybe it'll still slide. You can still slide with magnets, but maybe that'll be some new thing. But Christian, I think one of the things that you and I have talked about before, lamenting the fact that this is going to be apparently a direct sequel to a console, kind of a first for Nintendo. I mean, I guess you could argue Wii U to Wii, but even Wii U had some wacky new innovation, you know, the screen on the controller. This doesn't seem to be daring in the way Nintendo usually is with big console releases, unless there's something about these magnets that will be surprising, or there's some other feature we don't know about. But what do you make of a Switch 2 that is just more Switch?
I'm here for it, because while I think Nintendo, especially recently, has been the innovators, and historically as well, but recently, this great innovator company in terms of what console they deliver, historically, I think they are the best perfection via iteration of any console manufacturer as well. The hill, one of the the hills I will die on, I mean, I'm littered with hills that I can just stumble upon and die. You don't have to push me to die on a hill. I am happy to die on a hill. One of my many hills I will die on is the Super Nintendo and the Game Boy Advance being two of the best consoles to have ever existed of all time. And both of those are, I mean, it's in their name. The Super Nintendo, a Super NES, it's just the better version of the other one. And the Game Boy Advanced, it's the more advanced one of the other one. It's like, we found this thing, and now we've turned it to 11. You know, whatever. And even within, in that handheld space, I think Nintendo has really smartly, consistently iterated with feature bumps that don't raise price a whole bunch, whether it's the Game Boy Color, even with the Game Boy Advance, then going to the SP. And then the SP, I believe, was it the SP 101? It got like a screen refresh somewhere in there. And it's not, hey, now it plays these better games, but they're looking to tinker, to tweak, to improve. And I think those two consoles show this idea of, hey, we've struck gold, or we have something really good here right now. Let's continue to build on it. And so if that's what they're seeing with the Switch, and as Jill talked about, acknowledging Steam Deck as a competitor, or some of these other gaming, handheld gaming PCs as competitors, or now our emulators we all have in our pockets on iOS, you know, and that fuels a fire in them to make this thing, whether it's the UI is snappy, whether it's the pick up and resume really works really well, you know, something about it that makes it the easiest thing to pick up and play. That's super exciting to me. I love magnets only because I picture, anytime someone talks about magnets, I just picture insane clown posse wondering how they work. And that always makes me happy. That always, like, I don't, yeah. That always, that gives me a good laugh. But I feel like I'm curious what their data is on Joy-Con detached usability, but how often people did that. And is it just to do like the lazy gamer, I'm far, you know, like I detach so I can have my arms in a comfortable position, or is it going to have that weird split D-pad thing that made both sides of the Joy-Cons, in my opinion, not great because it didn't have a real D-pad. I'm very curious if they continue to lean into that as an up or a positive side of the console, because we never use that here. I mean, maybe sometimes we multiplayer that way when, like, oops, we need another controller, and the person that gets the sideways Joy-Con is always pissed.
Well, I'll tell you, my 7-year-old loves the detached Joy-Cons. That's his preferred method. I'm like, Jack, do we hook up the Pro Controller for Daddy? Can you get me a Pro Controller? Does it charge? Do we charge it? My son's always like detaching the two Joy-Cons and holding them in each hand. That's how he wants to play. We have 4 Pro Controllers that he's been gifted in numerous holidays and birthdays. And, you know, so that we could have a full Smash Brothers or a full Mario Kart session with the whole family. But, you know, he has an opportunity to use another Pro Controller. He wants to use them detached. Christian, you look like you had an epiphany.
I did. And I wonder if this is translation or something, or again, these are rumors upon rumors. I wonder if the magnet is them solving drift and they're just using Hall effect sensors,
dude,
because those are magnets.
They need to fix drift. The idea that this console
those are magnets
has sold this many units and has been out this long and that's still a problem, mm-hmm, drives me insane.
It drives me insane. All controllers that don't use that, any controller of PS5, I you know, replaced it myself. But when you have physical contact of things happening, and that's why I think it's Hall effect, that magnetic floating sensor, maybe it still is the same rail system and it just has an analog stick that works now. I'd take that either way.
Right. Well, I'm looking forward to the final official reveal of it, and it's just like, it's shaped like a cow and you write it somehow and yeah. like none of this is correct at all.
It's the sequel to that, the game they showed for the Switch, the milking the cow. We leaned into that. It's yes. just
first
cow.
Nintendo console that you actually ride.
Yes, 100%.
I wouldn't even blink if that happened. I'd just be like, yeah, that makes complete sense to me. Or maybe it's so far down the Tears of the Kingdom route that the whole thing is magnets, and it's just like you're using like Tears of the Kingdom to just construct your own shape. Whatever you want it to be. Yeah, it's just magnet tiles. It's Lego at this point. It's the Switch. You can buy four Switches and make Switch Voltron if you want. I'm into
as
that.
As long as I can put it in cardboard and have a VR version on my head, I'm in.
All right. Well, we'll obviously keep talking about Switch 2 until they actually tell us what it is.
and then we won't stop us from speculating. Then we're done talking about it.
I'll have no more word about it at all. No. Let's talk about – we got some fun games to talk about. So let's get into it and talk about what is on our playlists. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Jill, let's start with a game we talked about last week, but we talked about it looking in from afar, all of us so anticipating what this game is going to be. You've actually played Hades 2.
Yes, I have actually played Hades 2, and I literally got the code the day before they announced that they were like closing down the playtesting on Monday. So I'm like, let me in. I'm going to play really quick. Hades 2 is so brilliant. I'm not gonna lie. It is more Hades. I am a huge Greek mythology nerd. So I did play this on stream, and most of my stream is just me going like, that's an interesting interpretation of this person. It is smooth. It works. I feel like the combat is even better, even more fluid. It gives you even more options to go through than the first one. And I don't know if that's just because I played it so long ago and I was playing on a Switch or whatever it was, but it just feels so, so good. I love the story. It's starting to drip feed. You don't get to play all of it during the playtest, but you do get a sort of sense of the main character is the youngest of Hades' family, Persephone, the wife, and Zagreus is his son and the main character's brother. And you get the sense that something bad has happened to the whole family. But Melenoe, who is the main character, was saved by the witch goddess Hecate at some point very early in her life and has grown up now to face the Titan Kronos, who is involved somehow in the tragedy of her life. So there is some very deep lore going on here, and already you're getting it as you dive into the game. But there is also a lot of, like, Supergiant is so good at narrative and drip feeding and giving you humorous moments. I'm already in love with Phrynos, who is a frog, a giant frog that you can stop by and like hug every time you come back to the hub world. Just talk about how your day went, how your run went. The characters are all, you can feel the love, you can feel the jealousy, you can feel the hopes and perhaps not so hopeful. So much that you want to win, even though you don't know really what's going on. You want these characters to succeed. And on top of that, I think they've done a really good job in this playthrough that I've played so far of making every single run worth something. Even if you barely got through, or if you got to the end boss, you're coming back. They've got a cauldron that you can throw ingredients into and things will appear. Like, you can talk to the fates at one point if you get something, or you can summon a merchant and now the merchant's there, so you have to get bones because that's the only currency he understands. Or going through, and now there is some sort of like gardening type mechanic where you can find seeds and grow them, and then when you get them you can unlock things from the scroll of the fates that are kind of mini side quests. So like, you've got tons and tons of things on your mind all the time. You're trying to get more materials to unlock tools, which will help you get other materials, which will help you unlock more weapons. And the only two that I know of in the game so far are the Witch's Staff, which is a kind of mid-range spear type thing. Feels really good. You got to get it's good to stand back a little bit and get out of everyone's way. And then you have kind of two daggers, which is a really up close, fun, personal type. I really enjoy it, and it's not good because I don't keep an eye on like projectiles coming at me. So I'm just like, I'm getting in. And some of the upgrades so far are just so, you feel real powerful. You're knocking people back. You're pulling people in. You have the ability, because you are a character who has been taken in by this sort of witch like, goddess, your powers sort of reflect that. So one of your powers is called cast, and it puts a circle on the ground, like a little summoning circle that holds people in place with ghostly hands, so that you can run around and sort of attack them. And all of your attacks, if you hold down whatever button for the attack, has an omega attack, so, and it's all magic based. So I feel like there's a lot more magic involved in this particular version of the game. So there's just a lot that, even just from this early like play test, obviously it's a play test, they're not even in early access yet, but there's a lot going on, there's a lot of layers going on, and I am super interested to see how it all kind of builds up over time and keeps you going. And you know, I know there are a lot of people who played the original Hades, got to a certain point and were like, I can't keep going all the way through, like I'm not doing this, like I'm not getting any worth for it, and then just kind of fell off from there. So I'm wondering if they are using all of these to help fix that problem so people don't fall off that easily.
Interesting.
And we'll see. I wonder if they have other things that they are introducing for that reason. But, and of course, everybody's like favorite, like all the sexy gods, seeing like everybody new and all the new interpretations. They're so fantastic. I took about a minute breaking down Aphrodite because I don't know. Like, I remember her being sexy from the first game, but like, she's sexy in this game. I'm like, you are not wearing anything, except she is wearing like full sleeved and like thigh high, like golden boots. And she's got a shield and a wand, sickle sort of thing, spear, that looks a lot like Sailor Moon. And I'm like, I am so fascinated with the iconography here. So yeah, you can go check that out if you really want to see me dive into all of that. But
love it.
They love the source material. They love this game. You can tell they're putting so much into it, and they have a new story to tell, which I absolutely am in love with. It's great. Everyone, I hope, gets to play early access when it comes out. They are ending the playtest on Monday, the 29th, which is probably when people are hearing this. So sorry, everyone. I also really love, and you guys probably talked about this, how the playtest has worked, either intentionally or not, as a wonderful, wonderful marketing plan for the early access release. Obviously, people were going to be excited for Hades 2, but with the added element of like, please let me in, I want to play, everyone is doing it, my friends are having fun. Now, when they release an early access, like everyone who didn't get a chance to play it and everyone who did get a chance to play it is going to be on it day one. I think that's genius.
Yeah, masterfully executed. I love hearing you talk about it. I think you're the perfect person to talk about it, and I'm super jealous you got to play it. But wonderful details, and you have such a expertise on the subject matter too. So it's really cool hearing you talk about Hades too. It just seems like a home run. Supergiant is one of those developers I just have complete faith in them knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, and it seems like they're doing that so far.
I'm curious if there's like an unknown to it when we talked about Nintendo doing that with their consoles. And I think for a lot of folks, the story in Hades was a surprise, because in so many of these rogue type games, it didn't deliver the story in a way where, for me personally, I was like, yes, I died. I mean, that was a good run, but I want to see what's going on back at home. Like, that stuff was so compelling and so cool. And there was so much of it where very rarely did I feel like, oh, this again. Like there was always something new. And I'm curious if Hades 2 ends up having something similar that is just a slight unexpected or new tweak to the genre in terms of narrative or storytelling that no one's done before, which is a lot of pressure to put on a studio who already aced it once. But I'm like, can you ace it even more this time?
Yeah. Is there a sense in playing it that anything is being held back? I mean, obviously, as you said, there's only two weapons so far. So there's a lot there that we haven't seen. But is there anything else that you are maybe feeling like, oh, are they holding that back?
We don't know what's happened yet.
Mm, yeah.
Like they are drip feeding. Something bad has happened. I have been with Hecate since I was like almost a newborn. I don't know my parents that well. I don't know why it's happened. I don't know what that means to everything happening. For some reason, the Olympians didn't know of my existence, same as Zagreus. And we don't know why that is either. So there's a lot of story that is unfolding. And just for me being paranoid and not trusting things as they are shown, every time that I read something someone is saying to feed me exposition or dialogue or a story or narrative or anything, I'm like, okay, so according to what they understand, this is how, you know, I'm like, I wonder how much of this is going to be, there's going to be some kind of twist. There's going to be some kind of... Who knows? I don't like, obviously with Zagreus's tale, we sort of knew how that was going to go. He was looking for his mom. He was going to find his mom eventually. Like we sort of had that idea. For this, I really don't know. She's obviously looking to death to Kronos is like the tagline.
Right.
And what are those implications? Like talk about a roguelike, you know, a classic idea for resetting time. Killing Kronos.
Yeah. What does it mean to kill time? Like, is this a God of War type situation where you're like, personal vengeance is not worth the misery and cost to the entirety of the world? Or is she going to be the bad guy by the end of this? Like, what's going to happen here? I don't know.
We said this last week too, but I'm just so enamored by this notion of fighting your way back into hell. That's kind of a cool notion to hang a game on too. That's neat.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's Hades 2, and hopefully the rest of us will get a chance to get our grubby hands on it soon. Jill, you've also been playing a game I checked out a little bit because it's on Game Pass. It's called Another Crab's Treasure.
Mm-hmm. You can see my review on this, and one of the first things I say about Another Crab's Treasure is that when I started playing, I was terrified. I was going to have to tell people I did not like it. Because this is a beloved game. Anyone who doesn't know the indie space, Agro Crab is the developer. They're our beloved team. I have a little plushie from them back here. They have been making Another Crab's Treasure for several years, and it has been an indie darling. And people have been. It is essentially a Souls game, but you play as a crab, and that's already fantastic. The team itself is really funny, and they have very serious things to say, and they usually balance those out very well. But the thing about Another Crab's Treasure is that there are some, for me early on, technical and balancing things that made it really hard to get into. I was having trouble with like the camera going into a cliff and now I can't see what I'm doing. And in a Souls game, you really need to see what you're doing. I was having troubles with like either my character or enemy characters clipping through geometry or getting stuck in weird places where they could hit me or I couldn't hit them, which was again frustrating because I need those souls, which is trash in this game, but like I can't get it without getting hit and that is just so frustrating. Those are things I hope can be fixed. But the thing that is, everyone should check this game out because this is, as you go on, you get more and more powerful. The combat gets more deep because you're getting more and more things that you can upgrade. You're getting magic attacks and attacks that go along with each shell, as well as like different upgrades and boosts that attach to your shell that you can continue to get. And there are just a lot of different elements that continue to grow to make you more and more powerful so that you can handle things. It is a lot more Sekiro than like a Dark Souls. So you are trying to break the stance of the other person. And when you get into that groove, you feel really powerful. I think the shining star of this game is its narrative, is its characters, is the heart and personality that's in it. Because it goes from like making cute crab underwater puns to like really looking into depression and anger, and having depression and anger because you are in a world that is unfair and kicking you when you are down. And like, it is so, so relatable. And then it'll go back to like making a little like SpongeBob joke or something, and then jump into how we as a society deal with big, scary things on the horizon that might not be fixable, and how we might put our heads in the sand, or how we might focus on getting ours and not worrying about if anyone else is getting theirs. And it, by the end, it is a very satisfying and very perfect sort of ending for the game itself. Yeah, and it's just, it is funny. It is, and it's funny not in like the kind of like quippy, oh, I'm a cute little crab, quippy kind of way, but it is just like, they know how silly some of this is, and sometimes they really lean into it. Like, yeah, we know this is silly, and it's great. And if you get a chance to like read some of the fake brands on the game, like the game is littered with trash because it is some of the commentary they're talking about the environment. And so if you're looking at things, like there's even like apparently there's a QR code that will send you to a, like maybe getting Rickrolled or something like that. So I mean, there are jokes within jokes of this humor and the game design. The levels are so clever and fun, and each one is different, and each biome is a kind of different thing. I don't think we needed a poison swamp. Thanks, AgroCrab. But yeah, it's just by the end, you are really rooting for Krill, who is our main character, to get his, like to get his stuff together and to become a hero instead of just caring about getting his stuff back, but also feeling really bad that nothing he can do, he can't win no matter what, like even though he's winning all these battles, he can't win. And it's so much deeper and more serious than the original cartoony vibrant look to the game would suggest.
Yeah, I excellent review, and you have certainly played you know, it to completion. I have not. I jumped into this because I am somebody that has had a hard time finding the love for Souls likes. I'm just not drawn to them. That parry and dodge roll and managing stamina and stuff, none of that just mechanically has ever gotten its hooks in me. I've never found the joy in it. But it occurred to me that a lot of that sort of oppressive feeling that people associate with Souls-likes, and I certainly do, could be attributed to the setting. One of the trappings of Souls-likes, and this is because, you know, Dark Souls and Demon Souls, and literally every FromSoft game after it, has had this sort of dour, oppressive, dark, dreary kind of setting. You know, it is demons and ghoulies and ghosties and baddies, and you know, you're in a sad, scary place, and that's cool. But it's also been the thing that people have felt sort of goes hand in hand with the mechanics of what these games have innovated.
Yes.
And so you'll get Souls likes all stripes, changing up lots of things, but always sort of keeping that very dark tone. And I thought, hey, maybe a game that it could not be farther away from that tone. I mean, you touched on it a bit in what you were saying, but you know, it really is a vibrant, fun undersea, you know, it's a cartoon. It's a Saturday morning cartoon with a adorable hermit crab and his goofy friends in, you know, on the bright, sunny undersea beach that, you know, the sun is streaming through the beautiful water above, and everything that you encounter is sort of discarded human-sized things, and you're a little hermit crab-sized thing. And the real innovation mechanically, which you also sort of touched on, but I want to kind of underscore, is that as a hermit crab, you can have different shells. You can adopt a shell, and invariably the shells that you can find and use as your little back, you know, your armor in this game, are discarded garbage from human beings, you know. And there's 69 different ones that you can find and collect in this game, and each of them gives you a new ability or power or feature. And so there is incentive to find them, collect them, and decide how you sort of want to build out your character. And building them out is, do I want to have a soda can on my back, or a shot glass, or a, you know, who know, a tennis ball, you know, all kinds of these crazy things.
And I'll end up those examples. We'll say the soda can gives you a power that has homing missiles. The shot glass is more defensive, that it will spike up and make shards out of the shot glass. So, and if anything attacks you, it gets attacked. And then the tennis ball is called rollout. It will let you, like, kind of Sonic,
yeah,
like turn into a ball and roll into something very quickly. So like each of these has a very different build and gameplay design sort of in mind. And it really changes how you play the game.
And there's 69 of them. That's like... there's tons of depth there, and so you can really figure out the kind of build that you want to have. I'm still not in love with the combat. It's a simplified version of a Sekiro, you know, a Sekiro, yeah, or a, you know, Bloodborne or something like that. But still, you know, it's not, I didn't love it, but it's just such a joy to sort of be in that world. And the game also has some sort of light platforming stuff that I was really enjoying that you don't really see typically in those kinds of games.
Yeah. I will say too, for anybody who's not into the combat or that kind of harsh, like, because this game can get really intense and very challenging. If that is not what you are there for, this game has an amazing assist mode with a ton of different options. If you go into the assist mode, you can do things like make sure that the other characters have less life so that you don't have to do as much damage, or that you don't take as much damage. Or you can do things like the parry system window is so much wider, so that basically if you're hitting shield at all, you are parrying them. But the best one, literally the best one, is that you can give Krill a gun. It's just a giant gun, and you can one-shot anything in your way. So if you're ever awesome, getting like upset that you're not killing a boss, the developers are very clear. They want you to have fun in whatever way this is fun. If the narrative is the thing that is the juice for you, give them the gun. Shoot whatever you need to, and go through, because it's worth seeing this to the end.
Yeah, it really is very charming and very funny and fun and clever. And it does have some interesting things to say. Like you mentioned, the sort of currency of the world is microplastics that are all, you know, just sort of the detritus of human beings and everything. You know, you're finding the little things that you put on the end of the twist of a bread bag. You know, mm-hmm, you're finding that it's, you know, it's not without its commentary as well. So I was pretty taken with this. And as I mentioned at the top, it's on Game Pass. So, you know, yes, folks that are subscribed to Game Pass, there's no impediment to giving this a try. It's called Another Crab's Treasure. What else is on your playlist, Jill?
I will do quick shout outs for two games that I am so in love with. And it's not fair that these all came out in like the same week, because I had to really get through them. But Sucker for Love, Date to Die For, looks like a game that I would not initially have tried out. And I know a lot of people look at it and say, it's sort of, if you have played Doki Doki Literature Club, sort of in that vein. It is such a love letter to the 90s experience of anime. Like when you go into the menu itself is a shelf with VHS tapes of series of anime, of this anime called Sucker for Love. And you take the physical thing out and you put it in, and it's got the like, and last time on Sucker for Love, and it's got like the watermark for like syndication, and it's just like, oh, this is hitting me so hard. And I love when games do this, where it makes you, the player, a participant in what is going on. And it is sort of the first clue of what I love more about this game as it goes on. It gets really meta and it gets really weird. And it is, I don't want to spoil anything.
That does sound like Doki Doki, because that's what I was like. Does it have that kind of crazy meta layer?
Yes, it's got that. The game itself works on, you are playing essentially the series 1, series 2, series 999, and series, like, it's all scratched out. You can't see what it is. In order to unlock the second half of the game, essentially, you have to get the true endings. So each game series has a branching narrative, and it has a really fun, like, you know, when you finish a game, you can see the sort of branching narrative, like, you chose this way instead of this way.
Yeah.
You can go back and just jump right into just before the fork and make a different decision and get different results and see what happens. But like, you're sort of influencing things as you do this, and you will recognize the influence as you go throughout the game and as things are happening. I will shout out that this is a game with anyone who looks up a picture of it, it's got sexualized content, it's got violent content. The cool thing that I really appreciate the developer has put into this game, a spray bottle. It's one of the first items you get in the game. So if you are getting to a section that is overly sexual or violent, the game will give you a heads up, and like with the spray bottle icon, so that you can click it and just skip to the necessary elements that you need to know. So if you like have someone walk into the room at the wrong time,
spray bottle,
you didn't see anything. So it is so good, and it's so worth getting to the end. Cause at first I was like, oh, okay, I get what this is about. I don't know if I'm going to finish all of the, like, the true endings or whatever, but I'm so glad I did. And the only thing I'll say about the second half is, like, I've never been so happy to see like a Lovecraftian horror in my life. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So go check that out. Sucker for Love, Date to Die For. It is out. It just came out, I think, last week. And then something that just came out on Friday, which is getting a lot of buzz and doesn't really need me to talk it up, is Mariner Lords. And oh my gosh.
Yeah, this game is like crushing right now.
Yeah, I'm so in. I am sucked in so bad to this game. It's a problem because I have other games to play. And every time I boot up my computer, I'm just like, maybe I'll just check on my sheep, you know? Mariner Lords, my poor partner has had to hear so many tales about what's happening in my little world. Essentially, Mariner Lords is a game of Risk. You have like 10 or so territories on a map. You control one of them, and it's random what territory you control and what resources are strong in that area. You start basically with nothing. You've got a little tent with like three or two families who are homeless, so you need to build up their houses so they can do stuff, and then you need to make a hunting camp so that they can hunt, so that they don't starve through the winter. And it grows and grows because everybody, you know, the more you have, the more you need. But you also need to keep in mind that the other rulers of other places are starting to go from their one section that they rule to taking slowly over all of the other things around you. So you have to start like, oh gosh, I better start getting money so I can build up my army, so I can buy weapons, so I can buy like shields and start putting stuff together. But I just started trade, so I have to keep my mining operations going. And like, I just bought sheep, so I want to be able to make them produce a sheep. So I am trying to level up my civilization by adding more types of food or more allowance, more different types of clothing so that I can get civilization points. I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's like a skill tree for, okay, now I've unlocked a heavy plow and I can make sure that my oxen are actually doing the plow and I can make the fields grow faster so I can feed my people and not have to worry about the winter. And everything is, the clock is always ticking. So your months are just kind of flying by. And when you get to winter, you no longer have access to berries. The fields are not going to produce. Your animals that you've been hunting kind of can migrate or to lessen. They don't reproduce as much. So like, I've had a couple of winters where I'm really like skating by, like, please, please, please just eat the berries. Don't worry about the fact you have no meat. And you really care. So when the first time I had like bandits come in, I wasn't built up enough to have had any sort of fortification. So my people just had to go out and attack them. And I lost people. And that sucks because it's not just like, oh, these are the people in my army. They're the people in my village who were like, maybe he was like a sheep herder who got called up to spear. Now he's dead. So now I'm like, I need to replenish my sheep herder somehow, but I don't have enough people to run the mines. And so it's just like a continuing, like, I have to continually get better and get better for this. And I just want to play this. And I just want to, I want 5 more minutes to make sure that this happens correctly. And it, you literally can't stop playing once you start. So be prepared for that.
I love it. I've heard the same thing from so many people saying Manor Lords is very special. It has that, whatever that ineffable hook, that addiction thing where, like you said, five more minutes, and it's doing stuff that a lot of other games do, but is doing it so much better and so much more refined. You know, these kind of city builders, management sims, it's just kind of focused and doing it on a level that we haven't seen in a while. It's getting a huge amount of buzz right now. Sounds like you're among those voices in that chorus. Well, Manor Lords is also on Game Pass. So I almost downloaded it this week and I was like, I don't know if I need this in my life, but now I'm going to have to do that. Awesome. That is a really wonderful playlist. We're going to go to Christian, but first we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. All right, Christian Spicer, you have been playing another huge release this week that a lot of people are talking about. Tell us about Stellar Blade.
So I was provided a code for the game by Sony. And so there are two things I need to say at the beginning of this discussion about Stellar Blade that I think are both truths and can be held at the same time that maybe seem in disagreement with each other. But so one, I really, really, really like Stellar Blade. I really like Stellar Blade. One. Two, I really dislike the way this game presents every single female character. It is, I mean, in my opinion, I'm no expert on this, but just disgusting, misogynistic, and grotesque, not in a grotesque, like, cool, scary monster design, just... It sets the industry back several decades. It's in poor taste and in no way makes the game better. Your character has a suit that is called a skin suit. And I know a lot of Souls games have like you're naked and it's, you know, you have like you're debuffed because of that. And this one gets rid of your shield, but you also look like a naked, hipsy, busty woman. Ooing and awing and Catherine Zeta-Jones through the laser tripwire with Sean Connery, movements everywhere you go. And her other costumes aren't much better. And every other, you meet these female guards in the games who are like these badass warriors who have just huge breasts that are barely covered by like French lace, you know, like at the areola level, and it's full of jiggle physics. I mean, unrealistic jiggle physics. So like you turn the camera and it's like a jello jiggler, you know, just constant. And the camera, it has some really awesome cinematic God of War-esque camera moments, slow-mo kills, stealth attacks and stuff like that. But then it also has ones that are like, you're in a skirt and you slide under the door and the camera's like, wouldn't it be dope if we zoomed in at the front of her? And it's like, no, no part of that is dope. No part of that makes this game a better game. If I want titillation, I can find that easily. It doesn't make the game better. So those are the two like independent truths I hold equally about this game. And so when I discuss other parts about the game, when I discuss its graphics or whatever, please know I am not talking about the female character designs. That's not what I'm talking about. When I say it looks incredible, I love it, I'm not talking about that aspect of the game. Kind of related to those first two truths, I think this game, I think a lot of folks are kind of questioning how it might compare or contrast to Bayonetta. And to me, again, not an expert on sexuality or feminism or women's studies by any stretch of the imagination, but to me, I think there is a very big difference between these two games and franchises in their portrayal of women. In that Bayonetta, her character is sexual. Her character is in on it, both created by men and I think problematic for reasons, but Bayonetta as a character seems aware of what she's doing, who she is, and it's part of that story. She's posing. It's cheesy. It's cheeky. It's engaging with other characters in the world where she's flirting with the bartender in hell. She's flirting with the demon that's trying to kill her. She uses it to distract an enemy. It is part of that game, for better or worse. In Stellar Blade, there's nothing. There's no acknowledgement. There's not even like an anime version of like the guy who gets distracted by looking at these women that walk by and then, whoa, slips in a puddle and whatever. Like it just doesn't, she doesn't talk about it. Eve is the character's name. None of the characters address it. All of the male characters, I mean, some of them have like armor on armor, you know, it's like, oh, no skin showing, no, you know, male gaze, male hot dude portrayed in the game. And so it feels like it's literally there just to be like, hee, you know, game from the early 90s. And I think that is a very big difference about how games address a sexualized character, where one is aware of it, part of it, it is part of her character, and the other is like, this is just frosting we put on this thing to now send it out into the world. I think for my money, the Bayonetta approach is better. It seems like it's at least part of that story versus the Stellar Blade approach, which is, it adds nothing. And for me, it detracts from the game. I would much rather have enjoyed this game if my character was dressed like Solid Snake, you know, or in fatigues, or dressed like Wonder Woman in the first Wonder Woman film, you know, like, oh, that's real armor. That works. So I needed to say that at the outset, because I think it's important. And it bums me out that the game portrays women the way it does physically. It bums me out. What I really love about this game is that it is a modern throwback to a third-person action game that does so many of those things that I love so very, very well. It is Souls adjacent, whereas when you sit down to rest, like it says, like some of the enemies may reappear. But that doesn't really matter because you're not exploring the way you will in the Souls game or needing to backtrack on things. Stellar Blade, very much when you get into the main chunks of the game, is very linear, but a wide linear where there's areas to explore, to find secrets, to find weapon upgrades, to get things that build out your skill tree. So it still feels like you're poking around in this environment, but it also very much feels like a Bayonetta 1 or 2. Where like, this is the path I'm taking. I'm going to take down these enemies with this awesome, fast, visceral combat of a light attack, a heavy attack, a parry, and a dodge. And the upgrades to that feel constant and important. As your character is leveling up, it feels good. You get oh, do I want to use this? It gives me an extra attack after a perfect parry because that's the way I want to play. Or do I want to prioritize leveling up to get this move that allows me to reposition after a dodge that gives me an advantage around some of these bigger enemies? It does a lot of that combat stuff in a way that I find very satisfying that I think Rise of the Ronin was missing. Like Rise of the Ronin from Team Ninja, I was hoping that combat was going to click for me in that way. And for whatever reason, it didn't. I felt claustrophobic in the indoor environments. I never kind of got into that rhythm. I liked the combat. I think it was the best part of Rise of the Ronin, but it didn't grab me the way Stellar Blades did. Stellar Blades grabbed me in a way that, you know, feels reminiscent of those early Ninja Gaiden games, but iterated on now and not quite as fast or jumping around as much, but it very much is, I'm going to go in here, I'm going to figure out how to take down this big enemy while I'm doing it, which for me is not how I approach enemies in Souls games. It's like, I'm going to go in here and die 10 times as I try to watch to figure it out. And now I have an understanding. I will now try to play it, you know. And in Stellar Blade, it very much felt improvisational, where I was putting the pieces together as they were happening. And it didn't require a lot of that. Oh, I turned right and now I'm at an overpower boss. I shouldn't be here. It very much presents its story as you meet it. Pretty linearly. Linearly? Ooh, that feels weird when I say it.
Linearly.
I can't talk.
Linear.
Linoleum. Got it. New kitchen floors. And I really, really liked that. It was super fun and engaging and it kept doing interesting things along the way. It has a few open world or open hub areas that allow for extra side content and side stories. I did some of them, not all of them. I didn't find them to be necessary in a way like, oh, I'm learning more about this world, because I kind of didn't care about the world. Like the story that it's presenting is like a fallen Earth and you come back to save it and twists and turns and what's really happening and what really led to these enemies that you're battling. And that felt very forgettable. But that also kind of felt like a throwback to the action combat genre for me of like, I don't know why we're doing this stuff. We're going to go do it. And it's going to look cool along the way. And this game from a console debut for the studio, technically, again, leaving out the stuff I talked about at the beginning, technically, I am blown away by Stellar Blade. It is gorgeous. I don't know if it's, you know, real-time ray tracing or not. I was playing in the balanced mode, just like the 40 frames per second mode, which Digital Foundry said where they got their best experience. And I had an incredible, smooth frame rate experience there. Reflections, you're in these, you know, space station environments, you're in dark tunnels. Excuse me, hold on. Load times felt very short and fast. You're constantly in new environments. The enemy design is grotesque in a good way, like these kind of disgusting creatures with interesting body parts, like a shield or a big weapon, and what they do with it to signal their movements are fun. There are some misdirects where it's kind of like a Popeye wind up and then they punch you with the other hand. The first few times it happens, like, that's not how that's supposed to work. Really, really cool. And just technically stunning in a day and age where so many big AAA games come out. And Jeff, you and I sit here and say, well, wait a few weeks. You know, we really like the game, but let's wait for these patches to come in. I mean, from day one, this game played flawlessly. I had zero bugs. I never lost progress. I never had hard crashes. Just a very solid, awesome gameplay experience. My other only nits about it, from a gameplay wise, would be there are times where bosses, which are difficult, you when you die, you respawn like half a click away, you know, so you have to like walk to the thing and then you can skip the intro animation for the boss again. But it's like, just put me back in. You know, I'm going to be here 12 times, game. You and I both know I'm going to be here 12 times. Just like, get me back in. So I found that a little frustrating toward the end. I did turn it down to easy for the last two bosses, I think, because I was missing my parries real bad. And at that point, I think it was like 25 hours into the game. And I was like, I know I'm close. I think this is the last boss. Okay, there's more bosses. I'm close enough. So I did click it down there. But I think there's a whole lot to like in it. And I think it shows what this genre can be, and not everything needs to be a Souls game. You know, this definitely has trappings of that, but it very much more feels like the action combat. Everything's quick. I have my first hour with it, Jeff, is up on our Patreon for people to see the VOD. And I kind of talk about there of like, oh, weird. I kind of want to just dash at this enemy, but the Souls player in me tells me, no, I need to wait to see what it does. So I learn how to counter it. And it's like, no, you dash at it. It is quick. It is meant to be fast and get in there. And my only other nit, it has a few, to break up the pacing, a few like platforming style sections. And I think it kind of locks into animations in a way that makes that more frustrating than fun, where like the jump, you then step four times and maybe fall off a cliff versus, no, you're supposed to land there, Eve. You're supposed to land there. And so I played the whole thing, you know, hypocrite, whatever you want to say, put my money where my mouth is. I played the whole thing and I really enjoyed my time with it. But there is no world in which I think this wouldn't have been a better game with better female character design.
If it didn't make you feel so icky.
Yeah. I mean, not even icky. It's just not, it's just bad. There's zero value add in that. There's zero value add in those characters looking the way they did. And they're not part of the story. And even just a throwaway line, I would have like, explain it if you're going to do it, but they don't. It's literally just there to be titillating. And I think it sets the industry back and it's a real bummer. The combat and this kind of old school approach to third person action combat, I think, is exquisite. So I don't want to recommend or not recommend the game to folks. I think it depends on which side of that line they find themselves on, whether or not they can tolerate it or not. But I'm excited for what this studio does next, hopefully learning from this game and making some character design corrections going forward.
That's Stellar Blade on PlayStation. Are you playing on PlayStation 5, right? Is it exclusive to 5?
It's PlayStation 5.
Yeah. Rarity, honestly. What else is on your your playlist, Christian?
One game that I can recommend wholeheartedly. Uh-oh, Jeff, look what I dug out of my garage.
Oh, look at that.
It's a
plastic instrument.
It is a Rock Band 4 plastic instrument. They, Fortnite Epic, they promised that instrument support was important to them when they launched Fortnite Festival here months ago. And that day has arrived. Your old Rock Band guitars work in Fortnite Festival. To get them on PC, there's a few hoops you have to jump through. But if this is the PlayStation 4 Fender for Rock Band 4, it just works on PlayStation 5. Same if you have the Xbox One, it works on Xbox. There's a new guitar you can buy that also just works. Jill and Jeff, these games are awesome. I know we got sick of them.
I didn't.
It's so, well, the market got sick of them. It's real fun. It's real. I've always preferred the Guitar Hero clickier strum than the Rock Band guitar, which is a little bit of a mushier strum. So I've had to relearn the Rock Band strum, but I know Epic has all the money so they can do all the things. But when they bought Harmonix, this is kind of what I was hoping for. And they knocked it out of the park. It's real good.
Yeah.
I get to play Blink-182 as RoboCop or Alan Wake. Are you kidding me? Like you can fine tune your timing. You know, it does the thing where you get to like dial in your screen to fine tune to make sure your clicks are accurate. It has all the things, you know, as it gets harder, you have to put your pinky on the orange, the too many frets that you don't have fingers for, the bar chords, the double, the tilt to go into power mode.
So what you're saying is Rock Band is alive and well and living in Fortnite.
In Fortnite.
And it's better than it's ever been in some ways, where it defaults to no fail mode, you know, before you had to turn that on. And now it just keeps going. But the challenge, it's genius. The challenge is in the battle pass, which is where so many people look to for their challenges now. Instead of going into the old Activision style menu for Rock Band, like progressing the story and like, oh, do this on hard to unlock this. It's like, this is this week's or whatever, this long's battle pass to unlock, to do the play this song, to do that at this song, to do this, or group with these people to do that. And it's stuff that we've all been trained to do by Epic and Fortnite for so long now. And it's, I know that it's been in Fortnite Festival since its launch, but now that it has the guitar implementation, oh, it's good. Songs are $5 and I've spent
$5 per song. Ooh, that's rough.
I think there were $2 in Rock Band, so they've gone up a little bit. But as someone with a problem,
how many songs does it start with?
Well, so that it kind of has the Guitar Hero Live approach. It's as the shop updates, you get new, there's always free songs to play and they're rotating them in and out. And sometimes songs stay through store refresh. But other times it's like, oh, we're going to have the, like Billie Eilish is the new thing right now. And so a lot of those songs are in there to free to play. And so you don't have to spend anything to have a really fun experience. But if you want to own Make Damn Sure by Taking Back Sunday, like I did, you bought that for $5 because then you have that in your library.
There's only one way to make damn sure that you owned it.
Yes. Yes, there is. And that's with $5.
Okay.
It's really well done. You can play with friends. They say they're going to bring drums into it as well, which I also found my old
drum set right over there.
It's real good. It's dig out your guitars, y'all.
I'm doing that. I'm doing that tomorrow. That's
what
I
did a really good job with it. It's really good. So easy to recommend.
I'm resisting the urge so hard. Fortnite is so unfair. I've got so much that is coming up. May the 9th is going to kill any indie fan out there. You are trying so hard to get me to go into my garage and drag stuff out. I think Fortnite just said that they were doing Star Wars coming May 3rd, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't. I don't have time for this Fortnite. Why are you doing this to me?
Think of it this way. It's finally given us all a reason to have hung on to those instruments this long. You know, I knew I wasn't supposed to throw this in the garbage. And I've been proven right.
Hey, someone that came to our shows at UCB, Jeff, is a very happy camper right now for holding on to the gear we gave away.
We did give away a lot of that stuff.
All those years ago.
I still have one guitar. I do think it's an Xbox One, though, unfortunately. So you said there's hoops to do. I
believe it needs to be Rock Band 4. I don't think, like, for a while you could carry over your Guitar Hero guitars worked in Rock Band. I think right now it's just Rock Band 4 or these new guitars that they've made that are pretty hard to find. And Jill, to your point, I think it's really Epic's genius of keeping folks in the Fortnite ecosystem where there's cross progression across battle passes for doing all of these things, or there's something to do within this wrapper that I get to bring my RoboCop in from, my Alan Wake, my Nathan Drake, Master Chief, all of these characters into these other modes. And Jeff, we did a story a few weeks ago about everybody's playing these 6-year-old games still. Isn't that such a bummer? And I thought about that since we did that episode. But also 10 years before that, we were all on We Can Confirmed saying, I wish these sports games would just send out an update instead of making me buy a full copy every year. And now that's what we're getting. And it's great.
Well, not in sports games, but yes.
No, of course not. They make too much money. But in the other games, well,
there you go. That's Fortnite Festival with the guitar. I don't have to talk too long about my playlist. We already talked about another Crab's Treasure. But I wanted to mention another game that's really, really gotten its hooks into me, and I will probably be talking about it next week as well, so I don't have to spend too much time on it. But it's the new game from Clay, which is Rotwood. Clay, of course, the studio behind Don't Starve and Griftlands, which is a game I really dug. I don't think it got enough attention. So I pay attention when Clay does anything. I talked about this one during one of the Steam Next Fests. I played the demo. It's called Rotwood. It's very much my jam. It is a roguelite a brawler, a 2D brawler in the vein of a Golden Axe or a Final Fight or a Castle Crashers.
Linoleum.
Yeah. Linoleum. Thank you, Jill. There you go. Linoleum.
Rotwood, I don't understand how this game is sitting at mixed reviews on Steam. It makes no sense to me. I love it. I think it's awesome. They're already addressing a lot of the issues people have, which is sort of weird difficulty spikes and some some very persnickety, I think, complaints. This game is $10. It's $10. The amount of game you get for $10, I got it on sale for $8. And like the fact that people are like, ah, this game, I don't understand it. I think Rotwood is awesome. For $10, it's a no-brainer. Like,
it's also early access still, right?
Yes. It's like, also early access. Yes.
I think this is something we talked about last week with No Rest for the Wicked. No Rest for the Wicked. Game's not finished. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but No Rest for the Wicked has like had 6 updates in a week. They've done an update almost every day that has addressed major things, like completely changing the cost for repairs, and like they added super ultra wide support, 32.9. So like, oh, dude, I'm very happy with Moon Studios for that. Anyway, back to Rotwood and Clay. This game is beautiful. Beautiful, and all Clay's games are. Their art team is just incredible, and it looks like a cartoon, like a Don Bluth movie, or just a beautiful animated feature. It's so gorgeous. Anthropomorphized animals, and you are, you know, it's very much a standard roguelite in the style of a Hades or what's the game about being a cult leader?
Cult of the Lamb.
Very much. If you played Cult of the Lamb, very similar. You know, you've got your home base that you're upgrading by in various ways, getting new resources to be able to invest in your home base, at finding people in the world that you can bring back that will let you have new things in your home base. But most of the game is you're venturing out. You're going into these screens that are connected. You have to defeat everything on the screen in order for the exits to open up. You get some sense of choice as to which exit you want to go to, and then it will indicate what kind of reward you'll get in the next room, so you can sort of decide how you want to keep going. And you'll get really cool rule-breaking upgrades. So you'll get an upgrade that lets you do something that you wouldn't normally be able to do, and you can compound those Risk of Rain style, where you can just have this like wonderful list of accrued upgrades that you get, that, you know, like, for example, you'll get, you know, your dash will be way better every time you dash. A projectile will shoot off of your body, or, you know, just wild things that like that can, you can compound and stack and chain all these cool features to your character as you're moving through a run. Also, the combat system I find to be very fun. The weapon, there's all kinds of cool button combinations and combos to be discovered that result in focused attacks. Like, you can chain together different kinds of combos, and a lot of them are hidden. You have to figure them out. And each weapon has its own built-in combos and button combinations. And so, you know, finding a new weapon, purchasing a new weapon will change up the way you're playing the game considerably. And it's really fun. And there's, you know, armor. There's a lot of RPG elements, almost Diablo style, where you really do have to be out in the world discovering the loot that you can then bring back and upgrade at your blacksmith or whatever in your town. I'm having a blast with Rotwood. I'll talk more about it. It's got multiplayer. I haven't tried that yet. I want to. I think it would be even more fun teamed up. A lot of people's complaints about the game are that the solo is not balanced well. I don't think I've gotten deep enough into it to have hit that kind of difficulty spike, but it's also a roguelite. So, you know, if I die on a run, I'm having a good time launching into another run. The enemies are awesome. Just, it's so beautiful. It's so wonderful to be in the game that I don't mind, you know, repeating the same levels over and over again. I find the combat just fun, and I find the upgrade path to be really exhilarating. It's exactly what I love about roguelites. Rotwood at $10, it just seems like a no-brainer. If you like these kinds of games, this is an excellent version of it. So I don't understand the mixed rating on Steam right now. It just blows me away. All right, that's my playlist, and that is our episode of DLC this week. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Joe Grote, it's been so much fun hanging out with you, as it always is. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad that we were able to make all of this work.
I am too. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and the cool stuff that you do online.
Yeah, you can find all my stuff at theindieinformer.com. Go check that out if you are interested in following me on social medias. Me personally is on Twitter at Finruin, F-I-N-R-U-I-N. Or you could follow The Indie Informer at Indie_Informer, because of course, The Indie Informer is just one letter too long to fit on Twitter. And you can also check me out on the Indie Council. It is a group of indie-minded people coming together to talk about all things indie problems, fun things that we're having. So go check that out too.
Awesome. Very cool. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, if folks are listening to this show and they're curious what our beautiful faces look like, we put up audio. If you've been listening, we put up the audio.
You'll never know.
Too bad.
We only put up audio.
You can imagine, baby. We put up video segments of this show. Anyone can check out at our YouTube, which is at DLC Pod. The full video version is available for folks on demand, as you mentioned at the top of the show, Jeff, for our patrons at patreon.com/DLC Pod. And this show is on social media on Threads and Instagram as DLC Hype Train. And then I have a newsletter that people can subscribe to, casual conversational pieces about video games that you can find at christianspicer.substack.com, where the next one I'm going to be talking about pronouncing a word that describes a game that kind of takes you from point A to point B directly. It's going to be all about linoleum floors, and I think folks are going to love it.
Very cool. You can follow me on socials at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I have other shows. Why not check them out? You can hear me talk about movies and TV shows on the Filmcast. You can hear me talk sports on the Fan Controlled Show. And I do a comedy science show called We Have Concerns, all of which available wherever you get fine podcasts like this one. So check them out. Let's wrap things up now with our parting gifts. Give us a suggestion of what to do this week. Give us a parting gift. This is your parting gift. Jill, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the last time I was on, I suggested a book called She Who Became the Sun. It is a very intense and kind of, it is fantasy in the fact that it never really happened, but it is sort of historically based. And the sequel to that finally came out, and I'm very excited, and it's called, I'm gonna grab it, He Who Drowned the World. It is fun as a sequel because you already have all the basis. You don't need to like build up who these people are. You sort of already know the political implications of things. It gets so twisted, and like you care about characters who you hated before, characters that you loved before, you start to hate. You hate the fact that you love them. You want them to do better. You know, you don't want them to die, even though just a second ago you were rooting for them to get killed by another person. You want the main character you've been following this whole time. You're sort of like, wait a minute, are we doing the right thing? And as in any sort of media where that happens, the ending is fitting and wonderful. I can't say it's sad. I can't say it's happy. I can't say it's, but it's a combination of everything at once. And it is the end of the series. So you just have the one and the two. Wow. And I love the writing. I love the way that these characters are written. They are real. They are for good and bad, warts and all. These are real people having just, there are supernatural elements to things, but they're all rooted in humanity. I can have fun with like high fantasy and that kind of thing, but this is a really gritty human-based sort of, the entire series starts off with the main character going through a famine and being a girl, slowly realizing she's the only woman left because the families would rather have their sons than daughters, and the daughters just happen to not make it, you know, for one reason or another. So like that's sort of where you start, and it gets darker from there. Like, wow. So prepare yourselves for that. But there is in that world that is harsh and cruel, there is love and there is reason to hope and there is reasons to become better. And so it's not just a constant hitting you with anger and sadness. Really, really well done. That's called He Who Drowned the World. It's so good.
Awesome. Wonderful recommendation. Christian Spicer, what is your parting gift?
Learn how to tie a tie, whether a necktie or a bow tie, on someone else. Fun little challenge. I think a lot
without
of folks,
them knowing.
Yeah. You want to play a Souls like? Here you go. Welcome to my YouTube Shorts channel, Ties on Ties. I think this is probably prompted by me watching media of like the nervous person and like the presenter in the person, like the calming boss figure or the partner comes over and they're like, I got this. Or like the father figure to the son, like, I got this. And I think I've seen this enough in media that it's like, yeah, no, I don't know if you'll ever use it, but in my head, as everyone's here, podcast dad, as my podcast dad advice to give to everybody, it's like knowing how to change a flat tire. Hopefully you never have to do it. You can just call AAA. Hopefully you never see a kid freaking out because they're about to go give the big recital of their life and their tie's all wonky. But maybe you might be that person that's allowed to help settle that person's nerves and you can fix it up. And believe me, at least in my opinion, when I tell you tying a tie on someone else is very different than tying one on yourself.
I can't do it. I can't. I don't know how to do it. I would have to, I tie it on myself, loosen it, pull it over my head, put it on them.
Yeah. Yes. That is that's a growth mindset hack. And you have to hope the length is right. It's because it's not just like, oh, it's a mirror, so I do the other thing. It really feels like I am learning French. Why do my hands no longer work? So if you want to, you know, podcast dad advice, learn how to do it on somebody else. And maybe you can be that calming mentor figure in the rom-com of your life.
I love it. You know, we have different goals. That's good. I like that. My version of that was learning before my wedding, learning how to tie a bow tie, which I had no clue how to do. And it's actually a lot easier than you might think.
Like tying a shoe, but it's hard because it goes wide, then narrow, then wide, but it's the exact same tie.
My parting gift is a stand-up comedy special on Netflix that I really enjoyed. I'm a big fan of Dimitri Martin, his particular kind of cerebral humor. Very, very meta, very smart, very, very clever, very understated. I very much enjoy it. He has a new special, very recently released, called Dimitri Martin, Dimitri Deconstructed. And it's classic him, very funny, very, as I said, very, very cerebral, very, the jokes are thinkers oftentimes, but very fun. He does a bit in this special that I think is just genius. He's very, you know, famously has these doodles, these little sketches, not even sketch, little line drawings, simplistic line drawings that he uses as jokes. And he does a bit in Dimitri Deconstructed where he has a big pad of paper on stage, does line drawings and, you know, that are already written on them. And he does, flips through and does a joke for, you know, each page of this pad, must be eight of them or so. And he gets done with that and he goes, okay, now I'm going to go back through the pad and do a different joke for each drawing. So he has two ways to look at the same line drawing for every single one of them. And it's very brilliant, very brilliant. I'm a huge fan. And I think this is a really excellent, worthwhile, worth your time to check out Dimitri Martin, Dimitri Deconstructed. We also got a listener-suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at DLC Feedback. It comes from Guy, who writes in, Hi, I have a parting gift suggestion for this week. In case you haven't watched it yet, Shogun on Hulu. This 9-episode TV show, as the name suggests, is set in feudal Japan in the 1600s and tells a story of what happens after the ruling lord dies, but his successor is too young to rule. Political shenanigans and violence ensues. Think Game of Thrones twists, but with grim katana-wielding samurais everywhere. The show makes excellent work of keeping up with Japanese dialogue, or keeping the Japanese dialogue untouched, but the outsiders in the story are usually Portuguese explorers, and they all speak in English, even though they say they're speaking Portuguese. That's a minor nitpick. If you're feeling orphaned from blue-eyed samurai like me, Shogun will fill that void in your heart. Keep the world a better place, Gee. Thank you, Gee. Yes, the 9th episode just wrapped up. I am not caught up, but I have heard that it had a wonderful finale of Shogun on Hulu. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on the show, send it to us. DLCfeedback@gmail.com is where you do that. We appreciate it. All right. That's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Jill Grote and Christian Spicer. I was going to say my own name. Thanks to me.
Thanks to you, too.
Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason. My mouth just stopped working. My mouth is like, you know what? I'm done for tonight. It's Jason, Sherry, and T. Ryan Arnold. And you can get track for the show at store.dlcpod.com, like this shirt I'm wearing right now. Very, very cool. Our biggest thanks, of course, are reserved for our patrons at patreon.com/dlcpod. We are grateful for each and every one of them, but particularly grateful for our top tier patrons, our hype train patrons who become video games, because these games, these are classics, Christian. Classics!
Stone Cold Killers.
You remember comedian Aaron Trahan's game?
That's so funny. Is that how you? I always thought the title was like comedian Aaron Trahan. Like it was like a commanding, like comedian and like telling someone to do it. Like comedian Aaron Trahan. I thought you had to go.
Oh, comedian is a verb in this?
Look,
in your
interpretation? I was young. You had to go comedian Aaron Trahan. So that's why I never got to it. Much like
joke
my cousin's punch out. You had to get to the final boss.
Everybody you got
to
joke him up.
Aaron Trahan. And you had to comedian him.
Yeah. It was a simpler time where, you know, now you're playing Souls-like games. You're trying to read the boss, learn the boss. Back then it was like, joke to the right, pun to the left, you know?
Hey, what are you trying to say right now, Jeff?
You were comedianing him up. It was the first, and as I'm aware, only stand-up video game, trying to convey the stand-up experience.
In that old Sierra style, too, where you would type. I mean, I remember as someone who has two Billboard charting stand-up albums under their belt, I remember playing this game as a youngling and thinking like, you have to type the premise in, and I'd be like,
the entire game is just typing a comedy set into a terminal.
I was like, have you all heard of that one about airplane food? And the game would just say, that's not a valid response. And I'd be like, oh, I know it's about
B-O-Y. You're a great audience.
I'm sorry. Enter.
So space. Great to be here. Enter.
I'm
How
sorry,
about
I don't understand.
That airplane
Great.
Food?
And like the background, you couldn't tell what to click on to interact with, so it was just typing.
It was an Infocom text adventure of being a comedian.
Look, say what you will. I heard that's how Dimitri Martin wrote his whole newest special was in comedian Aaron Trahan.
The craziest thing, I know you played that version. We all remember that version. But do you remember that they did a remaster of this game, a remake of it? More remake than remaster. And it was right around the time that the Wii balance board came out.
Go on.
And it was a stand-up game where you literally had to stand up. And you just had to stand on the Wii balance board. And
you had to go.
Boy, it's great to be here. You're such a great audience. How about that airplane food? But you had to stay balanced on the balance board.
And if I remember, if you played it, you didn't have to have all of these things, kind of like Rock Band. But if you had all of the pieces, you also had to hold the Wiimote like a microphone, and
That's
it would
right.
detect.
That's right. It would detect if you dropped your hand in any way.
You couldn't drop the mic until you dropped the mic, right? It had to be at the right time. That's and then right. if you had the Animal Crossing bundle with the little speaker, you could actually deliver your set to a bunch of me's out there going, boo, wee, wee, wee,
there
wee.
There was one SKU of the game that had a little Wiimote holder that was a mic stand that you just put in front of the balance board.
It was really awkward when they made the condom for that also, so you wouldn't break your TV and you had to like wrap the whole mic stand in that big silicon padding. Because I remember people were breaking TVs with that mic stand, all while trying to comedian Aaron.
But it was cool because if you put the wrist strap on, you could throw the mic stand and then pull it back to you.
You could really Taking Back Sunday the microphone that way. You could just constantly swing it.
Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, you know?
I think the text adventure is still my favorite way to play it, though.
True. Anyway, comedian Aaron Trahan, great, great game. Another great game is the Scott Lambert game. Do you remember Scott Lambert, the game?
Yeah, as my dad used to pronounce it, Tarjay.
Yeah. Doesn't make any sense at all.
He's going to play the Scott Lambay. You know, he always had the funny accents on it. Like, you know, dungarees were jeans. My dad, full of dad jokes. So he'd always want to, he's like, oh, you going to go play the Scott Lambay? Enchanté. And I'm like, oh my God, dad, leave my room, please. Yeah.
Your dad was weird.
I mean, but an incredible French cook.
When Cult of the Lamb, came out, I was all excited that was maybe this franchise. It was like, was it Cult of the Lambert?
I did kill a lot of people in Scott's name.
Yes, as did we all. you remember the marketing for this game? It was like, it said, like Lambert to slaughter. It was a hardcore first person shooter back in the days of, you know, really frag, like how many frags did you get? You would shoot and it would just people would explode in chunks of meat, you know? It was all like lamb shanks.
And at the end, you had to see if you got off scot-free
in
the court case. And the judge would be like, we are gathered. And you're like, I'm gathered here to Lambert this place up. Pew, 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 pew. And then you jump out of the side of the building. And it was very like X stream, you know, like I remember when you escape out of the court. And I don't know why the court apparently was at the top of like the Die Hard tower, but you like shoot your way out of the court and then like pull the ripcord on your parachute. And I remember thinking like, hell yeah, parachuting away from court. That was awesome. It made
parachuting away from court. Yeah.
But it was,
have you ever tried actually parachuting away from court? Cause it works a lot less well.
Why do you think I quit being an attorney? Every day I would walk out of that courtroom, pull the parachute and it would just behind me.
Well, in a way you did parachute away from court, didn't you?
I did, right into the soft landing of playing Scott Lambert with my dad watching me. He still watches me when I play it, by the way. He comes over to the house.
He's like, I made some French toast for you. Thanks, Dad. Also fries. Those are the only things I know how to make.
I would love if it was Cult of the Lambert, though. That would have been
awesome. Imagine if you're a French chef and the only things you know how to make are French toast and French fries. I am a French chef. What do you make? Toast and fries.
Oh, what do you expect from me?
Those are some
lost
games.
Our French listeners are down zero, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, French listeners. They were already mad at us for other reasons, though.
Hey.
Not enough smoking in this show.
Touche.
If you'd like to have your name become a video game in a very respectful, cool way, become a Hype Train patron at patreon.com/DLCpod. All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.